This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. How long since Naked Id has been displayed so brazenly to a nation's people and embraced as rectitude by its most powerful men? How long since a country's professed values, its principles, even its deodorizing pieties and hypocrisies have been so swiftly repealed? President Trump is right, in this at least. He has accomplished more than any president before him, ever.
If I could just actually ask question, Mr. Trump. You didn't let me ask my question.
You've been asking a question for 10 minutes. Please sit down. Go ahead.
How did those impact your opinions on the allegations against
Well, it does impact my opinion.
If you don't mind, after I'm finished, if Ouija or Hallie or Vivian or one of our female colleagues could go after me, that would be great. Mr. President, just to follow up on these allegations against Brett Kavanaugh.
What does he mean by that? Explain. What does that mean?
I think it would be great if a female...
What does it mean?
It would be great if a female reporter would ask you a question about this issue. So if you don't mind...
I wouldn't mind that at all.
Talk loud. Talk over. Purposeful conversation is tender. The annihilating foghorn blast, that's tough. Authentic.
I know I'm a single white male from South Carolina, and I'm told I should shut up, but I will not shut up if that's okay.
South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, who now has truly buried his dearly departed friend John McCain, condemned the Democrats for cynical delays while embracing the GOP's cynical rush. With teeth bared, fingers jabbing, and righteous indignation so pointed it could slice an overripe tomato.
Would you say you've been through hell?
I've been through hell and then some.
This is not a job interview. This is hell.
This
is going to destroy the ability of good people to come forward because of this crap.
10 days of hell, hell, hell. That's what comes of entering the public square. Christine Blasey Ford knew it, and she's suffered intermittent hell for 36 years. Hillary Clinton endured 11 hours in one sitting on Benghazi, essentially accused of murder. She didn't do it, but she didn't interrupt, scream, or weep. She knew she couldn't. Brett Kavanaugh knows he can. Talk over, talk loud.
You talked about drinking and sexual exploits, did you not?
Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy.
Senator, let me take a step back and explain high school. I was number one in the class.
I thought only the Senate.
You got this up. I'm going to talk about my high school record if you're going to sit here and mock me. My family and I intend no ill will toward Dr. Ford or her family. But I swear today, under oath, before the Senate and the nation, before my family and God, I am innocent of this charge.
Tears, as long as they are bracketed by anger and trail down the face of a prosperous white man, are righteous. You've got to deny, 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 and push back on these women, Trump told a friend accused of sexual overreach, according to the Bob Woodward book Fear. If you admit to anything and any culpability, then you're dead, Trump reportedly said. You've got to be strong. You've got to be aggressive. You've got to push back hard. You've got to deny anything that's said about you. Never admit.
All four people allegedly at the event including Dr. Ford's longtime friend, Ms. Kaiser, have said they recall no such event. Her longtime friend, Ms. Kaiser, said under penalty of felony that she does not know me and does not believe she ever saw me at a party ever.
Are you aware that they say that they have no memory or knowledge of such a party?
Yes.
That's Ford with the Republicans' chosen interrogator, Rachel Mitchell.
Do you have any particular motives to ascribe to Leland?
I guess we could take those one at a time. Leland has significant health challenges, and I'm happy that she's focusing on herself and getting the health treatment that she needs. And she let me know that she needed her lawyer to take care of this for her, and she texted me right afterward with an apology and good wishes and etc. So I'm glad that she's taking care of herself. I don't expect that PJ and Leland would remember this evening. It was a very unremarkable party. It was not one of their more notorious parties, because nothing remarkable happened to them that evening. They were downstairs.
Leland has since stated that she believes Ford, even if she can't remember. Trauma has the ability to sear. On the other hand, alcohol has the power to erase. He may have been too drunk to record what may have been to him an unremarkable event, a joke. But it's Ford, who Lindsey Graham generously says is mixed up, because he knows the sole reason for this farce. And so does Kavanaugh. Because it can only be about one thing.
This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups. This is a circus.
I'll point out to you that Judge Justice now, Neil Gorsuch, was nominated by this president. He was considered by this body just last year.
California Senator Kamala Harris.
You both attended Georgetown Prep. You both attended very prestigious law schools. You both clerked for Justice Kennedy. You were both circuit judges. You were both nominated to the Supreme Court. You were both questioned about your record. The only difference is that you have been accused of sexual assault. How do you reconcile your statement about a conspiracy against you with the treatment of someone who was before this body not very long ago?
Irrelevant, and not all that remarked upon, because it's axiomatic to observe that truth is whatever you want it to be in today's America. But there is a law against perjury. If anybody still cares, Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal.
As a federal judge, you're aware of the jury instruction, falsus in unibus, falsus in omnibus. Are you not? You're aware of that jury instruction?
Yeah, I am.
You know what it means.
You can translate it for me, Senator. You can do it better than I can.
False in one thing, false in everything, meaning in jury instructions that they can disbelieve a witness if they find him to be false in one thing. So the core of why we're here today really is credibility. Let me talk.
The core of why we're here is an allegation for which the four witnesses present have all said it didn't happen.
They didn't say it didn't happen, but that they didn't recall. Kavanaugh dissembled throughout his testimony about having no role in the George W. Bush White House and policies related to the detention of alleged terrorists. He misrepresented several of his legal decisions, arguably to make them seem more liberal. For instance, he said one of his decisions protected the environment. Not really. On a lighter note, he likely lied about the meaning of a devil's triangle and Renata alumnius and FFFFFFF. The usual meanings, sexual in nature, are readily available online. Kavanaugh said he only cared about sports and studies and church, that he hardly drank. In later testimony, he said he drank beer and that he did embarrassing things, that he liked beer, liked it a lot. Likes it still. don't you? This week, the Democrats called persistently for the FBI to examine the new allegations against Kavanaugh. The Republicans said no, he's had so many background checks. The Dems said it was the usual practice when new and serious charges emerge. As I write this, I mean literally as I write this, President Trump has ordered the FBI to conduct an updated investigation of Kavanaugh, apparently in response to pressure from undecided senators, led by Republican Jeff Flake. For his part, Kavanaugh has always affirmed that he's as open as a peony in midsummer, but not exactly enthused about further scrutiny from the FBI.
I wanted the hearing last week.
I'm asking about the FBI investigation.
The committee figures out how to ask the questions. I'll do whatever. I've been on the phone multiple times with committee counsel. I'll talk to...
Judge Kavanaugh, will you support an FBI investigation right now?
I will do whatever the committee wants to...
Personally, do you think that's the best thing for us to do? You want to answer?
You know, look, Senator, I've said I wanted a hearing, and I'd said I was welcome anything.
Lying to an FBI agent in a formal interview is a crime and an impeachable offense. As I observed at the top, yelling, fuming, talking loud and talking over, in short, bullying, now is seen as a mark of authenticity and an acceptable political tool. But it's still wielded crudely, like the first time apes picked up a bone for use as a weapon. Our system of government is too fragile for apes, and it may be too fragile for us. I leave you with this from John Adams.
Remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide. It is in vain to say that democracy is less vain, less proud, less selfish, less ambitious, or less avaricious than aristocracy or monarchy. Those passions are the same in all men under all forms of simple government. And when unchecked, produce the same effects of fraud, violence, and cruelty. Individuals have conquered themselves. Nations and large bodies of men, never.
Democracy can't protect us. We have to protect it. You know what to do.
Coming up, the purging of voters from the rolls is a ritual of housekeeping and racism.
This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Kavanaugh confirmation hearings proceeded with urgency, to the sound of a stopwatch that only the GOP could hear, ticking down, down, down.
I mean, obviously, this was an 11th-hour ambush by the Democrats.
Now, at the 11th hour, with committee votes on schedule...
And frankly, we've reached a point where it's time to end the circus.
Make that three allegations, all of which have brought added intensity to the process.
Should the proceedings be delayed until these allegations are investigated?
Absolutely not.
Why not? Why not delay for 10 days or 10 weeks or however long it would take for, say, Mark Judge to come out of hiding? After Antonin Scalia died, we lived with an 8-member Supreme Court for 14 months because then Senate Republicans insisted on patience.
We're not going to move or even discuss the qualifications of any nominee until after the presidential election.
Obviously, in this case, the clock is set to hit zero on November 6th, when the Democrats have a reasonable shot at taking over the Senate and making it even tougher for a Trump nominee to the High Court. Indeed, the Republican hold on the Congress is so slight, the president seems to be laying the groundwork for accusations of illegitimacy if the Democrats take a house or two, by suggesting on Wednesday that China plans to butt in.
They do not want me or us to win because I am the first president ever to challenge China on trade.
But we don't need China or Russia to throw sand into the gas tank of democracy because we're doing that ourselves, systematically and increasingly for more than a century. And we've been doing it by keeping people from voting. This past summer, the Brennan Center for Justice released a new report on voter purges. It documented 16 million voters removed from the rolls between 2014 and 2016, almost 4 million more than were removed between 2006 and 2008. And the areas with the most dramatic culling, exactly the regions that until 2013 were so historically unfair to eligible black voters that the Voting Rights Act subjected them to pre-clearance from the Justice Department.
Pre-cleared means that any changes that that state or that county were going to make in their voting laws had to be okayed by the U.S. Department of Justice or the federal courts before that change was made.
Carol Anderson is a professor of history at Emory University and author of One Person, No Vote: How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. She says that the previous law, the 1957 Civil Rights Act, had been insufficient to deal with the disenfranchisement of black voters in the South.
By the time that the U.S. was fighting the Nazis, only 3% of African-American adults were registered to vote in the South. These states implemented new laws, new purges, and the Civil Rights Act couldn't deal with it. The Voting Rights Act could, because of preclearance, because these states could not implement a law, then run elections based on disfranchisement, have politicians who had been elected because of disfranchisement, who were crafting new disfranchising laws. The Voting Rights Act really short-circuited that.
These jurisdictions had been caught red-handed and were required to pass federal muster before enforcing any of these rules intended to suppress the vote, which they claimed was an onerous burden and by the 21st century no longer necessary because they'd cleaned up their act. And in Shelby County versus Holder, the Supreme Court agreed with them.
The county commissioners in Shelby County, Alabama, had begun annexing vast parcels of land around Calera City. All of this without getting pre-cleared by the Department of Justice. So they're violating federal law. There had been one lone black city councilman in Calera City. The lone black councilman moved from a district where he was going to get elected to a district where over 70% of the residents had voted against Barack Obama. In the next election, after all of this redistricting, Calera City no longer even had one black councilman.
And the Justice Department sued Shelby County, saying it was in violation of the preclearance requirements in the Voting Rights Act.
And the U.S. Supreme Court, with Chief Justice John Roberts writing an opinion for a 5-4 decision, said that, one, racism was no longer the kind of prevalent force that it had been that gave rise to the need for the Voting Rights Act. He pointed to black elected officials, Hispanic elected officials, the increase in black voter turnout. And he said, so it's clear that racism is just not operating in the United States, at least not at that kind of high level. He said that the Voting Rights Act didn't take into account the changing dynamics of America.
Let's just say that the Roberts 5-4 majority was a case of premature recalculation about the level of racism in the electoral process. Comes now the Brennan numbers, which shows that the voter purges suppressing the black vote is highest in precisely the places where the court decision let these jurisdictions off the hook. In other words, they went right back to their former practices.
You hit it head on. We had every indication of this. We had Alabama in 2011 that passed a voter ID law. Now, when Alabama was working on this law, the Republicans recorded themselves talking And they said, we need to figure out how to depress the black voter turnout. And then all of the racism pours out. You're going to have all of these Aborigines and these illiterates getting on these HUD finance buses and going to the polls. And so they crafted a voter ID law targeted at African Americans to depress the vote. But that was in 2011, before Shelby County v. Holder. Immediately after Shelby County v. Holder, boom, Alabama begins to implement that law. The same with Texas. And so these states were just poised. They had these laws drafted, ready to go. And the purging was a key piece of it. Here in Georgia, our Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, who's now running for governor, has a program called Exact Match. What Exact Match does is it says that your voter registration card has to exactly match what's in the Bureau of Motor Vehicles database, say you have a driver's license, or from the Social Security office. Now, where that gets dicey is say that your name is hyphenated, Garcia hyphen Marquez, and you hyphenate it when you write it for your voter registration card. But say on your driver's license, in the driver's license database, there's not a hyphen there. Not having a hyphen gets you kicked out of your voter registration and your voter registration is denied.
Now, it's not just purges of the voter rolls. There's many other classic tools of voter suppression. I just want to make the point that this is not some sort of new development.
It has a long, sinister, sordid history. In 1890, during the rise of Jim Crow, the state of Mississippi was trying to figure out how do we stop black people from voting. And they devised what was called the Mississippi Plan, such as the poll tax, where you had to pay in order to vote, such as the literacy test, where you had to read sections of the Constitution, either the state Constitution or the U.S. Constitution, and interpret it to the liking of the registrar, such as the white primary, where only whites could vote in the Democratic primary, the grandfather clause, the good character clause. That was an array of devices that created a package of disfranchisement targeted at the black population. They couldn't just say, we don't want black people to vote, because there was this thing called the 15th Amendment to the Constitution that said that the right to vote shall not be abridged on account of race, color, or previous servitude. And so they were trying to figure out then, how do we eliminate most of the black voters, if not all, and still remain constitutional? That framing led to going after societally imposed characteristics on a people and then making that the litmus test for access to the ballot box. So poverty, coming out of slavery, African Americans were impoverished. There was no 40 acres. There was no mule. That kind of poverty then played into the poll tax. The significant massive underfunding of black schools led to high illiteracy rates, and so therefore requiring people to be able to read and interpret a large segment of the Constitution as if they have their JD from Harvard is that you're setting people up to fail, but you're using the cloak of reasonableness by saying, we really believe that voters should be able to understand what the laws are in our state because we want an engaged citizenry.
You spoke of reasonableness. Even today, the various attempts to suppress the vote are justified under the pretext of eliminating voter fraud, which would be, I guess, a perfectly good rationale if there really were any voter fraud going on.
Right.
Is there?
It is so negligible. Justin Levitt, a law professor out of California, did a study from 2000 to 2014, and he looked at all of these elections, and he found that in 1 billion votes cast, that's billion with a B, that there were 31 cases of voter impersonation fraud, where somebody had pretended to be somebody else to vote. That's hardly the rampant, widespread voter fraud that we keep hearing about.
considering many of these purges take place in Democratic districts where a lot of populations of color reside, is there any reason to think that it effectively changed the presidential election or the balance of the Congress?
It clearly had an effect. I mean, we're talking about millions of voters removed off of the rolls. Begin to think about how Trump basically won the Electoral College on the back of 80,000 votes in three states. Those purges have effects. Those purges, and it's not just the purges, there are these other mechanisms, what voter IDs do, what gerrymandering does, what moving the polling stations, what not providing enough resources in polling stations in minority neighborhoods, all of those combine. But voter suppression, including the purges, helped put Donald Trump in the White House.
In your book, you describe what you call that election's most misunderstood story, and that was the disappearance of black voters. Because compared to the previous presidential election, the black voter turnout dropped from 66% to under 60. In Milwaukee, it went from 78% in 2012 to 50% in 2016. How do you interpret those statistics?
In the 2008 election, Barack Obama was elected president. He had an incredible ground game, and that ground game brought into the fore 15 million new voters. The demographics of those 15 million, overwhelmingly black, Latino, Asian, young, and poor. That coalition then became targeted in these voter suppression techniques. Because just like the Mississippi Plan of 1890, where I talked about how they couldn't say we don't want black people to vote, so they went after these kinds of characteristics, societally imposed characteristics, the same thing happened. So with purges, for instance, minorities, young people, and the poor do not vote in every election. So if you have secretaries of state who use not voting regularly as the litmus test for purging, what it does then is that it focuses that purge on those groups, on that part of the coalition that put Obama in the White House.
Let me ask you one more thing. For a century after the Civil War, voter suppression, Jim Crow, racial segregation, and so on, were kind of an equal opportunity enterprise. Democrats and Republicans joined arm in arm to disadvantage minorities. Only in the 60s did this become a partisan issue. Today, the efforts that you're talking about, are they not the province of one political party when it's in power in those jurisdictions?
Yes, this has been a Republican agenda. Now, there are Democrats in certain areas that have some semblance of one of these kinds of mechanisms. But to get the whole array, the 21st century version of the Mississippi Plan, we're seeing that implemented in Republican strongholds. And we're seeing that implemented exactly because of what you talked about. With the advent of the Civil Rights Movement that led to the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, and signed by Democratic President Johnson, there was no place then, as the Southern Democrats saw, for them to be in the Democratic Party, because now this was a party that said, we are committed to citizenship rights. We are committed to equal rights. We are committed to equality. And the Southern Democrats, these are the unreconstructed rebels, are sitting there going, there's no place for me here. And you have the Republicans via the Southern strategy then saying, we've got a place for you here in our party. And that toxin then was brought into the Republican Party, and it took over. I mean, Paul Weyrich is one of the founders of the Heritage Foundation and also of ALEC, which was the organization that crafted a lot of these voter suppression laws that spread throughout these Republican states. And he said, look, we don't want everybody to vote. Frankly, our leverage goes up when the voting population goes down. And so that is the blueprint. What we're seeing is a kind of doubling down on voter suppression as the population becomes increasingly diverse and increasingly repulsed by these right-wing policies of the Republicans.
Carol, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bob. This was a wonderful conversation.
It was. Carol Anderson is author of the new book, One Person, No Vote: How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Among the many parties pushing for the confirmation of Judge Brett Kavanaugh is the Judicial Crisis Network, a political nonprofit committed to, as it says on its website, strengthening liberty and justice in America. As recently as this week, that took the form of ads meant to drum up support for Judge Kavanaugh.
With no valid reason to block Kavanaugh, Democrats started a smear campaign. Disgusting accusations. Unproven. Discredited. Kavanaugh denies them.
Now, if you or some enterprising political reporter were interested in the Judicial Crisis Network's funding sources, you'd be out of luck. The JCN is a 501c4 in the eyes of the IRS, a so-called social welfare group that is not obligated to disclose its donors so long as its primary spending is non-political. That is, until the Supreme Court earlier this month let stand a lower court ruling that has the potential to throw open the shades and compel dark money groups to accept a more transparent status quo. Maybe. Michelle Yehi Lee is a national reporter covering money and influence in politics for The Washington Post. Michelle, welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
When the Supreme Court declined to review the case earlier this month, it seemed like that might transform the nature of dark money politics. For anyone with an interest in transparency, what was the most optimistic series of events that could flow from that lower court ruling?
If you're someone who is interested in the identities of the donors who have been giving to these dark money groups, the rosiest scenario that could happen here is that the groups start disclosing many of their donors who you had not heard of before as early as October 15th, which is the next quarterly deadline for these groups to file their documents with the Federal Election Commission. That would be quite monumental.
But then reality rears its head. A new disclosure environment would require two federal agencies, the FEC and the IRS, to promulgate new rules and to adopt them. But there, Michelle, we run into political and bureaucratic dysfunction. Tell me how.
The Federal Election Commission right now barely has a quorum. It's supposed to have six commissioners to vote on matters, to decide whether to enforce the law, enforce regulations, hold groups accountable if they run foul of the law or regulations. But the FEC right now only has four commissioners, which is the bare minimum vote you need in order to do anything. The four commissioners are split along ideological lines. Two of them are Republican, two of them vote Democrat. So it's very difficult for work to get done there. And this has been the case for a while now. The FEC now needs to come up with brand new regulation, which takes months to write. And then it has to go up for a public comment period, which is probably another month or two. And then it has to come before Congress for at least a month. So there's a long way to go until some clear guidelines are given. On the other side, the IRS has really chosen to protect the donors' identities rather than to disclose their identities. And this is the way the IRS has been moving recently because they believe that there's too much room for error, that there have been leaks of donors who did not want to be disclosed. So the IRS has moved away from disclosure. So it's really unlikely that these government agencies are going to do anything in time to make a huge difference for the midterm, certainly, or even in time to make a real difference next year.
And let's just say, in some fantasy world, both the Federal Election Commission and the IRS do pass some explicit rules governing 501c4s and a similar category, 501c6s. If we know anything from history, it's that political money adapts. If you're a political high roller and rules change, you know, you're going to find a new way to donate. If you ran the Michelle Yeohe Lee Political Action Committee, what would be your next move?
So if I were the Michelle Yeohe Lee Social Welfare Nonprofit, I, as a nonprofit, could say to a donor, could you give me some money to help flip the Senate, and then I will use your money in whatever way it takes to get there. So these groups are now changing the way that they're asking donors for money. They might be asking, do you generally support what I support as a group? Please give us money. And then maybe they'll try to use the money for a political purpose. It's really unclear if that's allowed, but that's one creative way that the groups might start doing it. Another way that the groups might start operating is that they might give it to an affiliated super PAC. So I, as a Michelle Yeohe Lee nonprofit group, take the donation, and then I make a donation to a super PAC instead. That way, the super PAC only discloses the nonprofit that gave the money, the Michelle Yeohe Lee nonprofit, and would not have to disclose any of the donors who gave the money to the nonprofit. So essentially, it's adding one more layer between the identity of the donor and whatever would trigger the disclosure of that person's identity.
Also known as money laundering.
That is what some critics might call it. I wouldn't, as an objective reporter, call it that.
If there is a change in the political donor ecosystem, at what point do you think the status quo will change? By the 2020 presidential election, for example?
Although it's not officially in effect, and we may not see any sort of official change in behavior for the midterms, it's already started altering behavior of donors and super PACs and nonprofits. The groups that I've spoken with, the donors that I've spoken with, have been aware of a possible change coming down the pike. And when the lower court ruling came down in early August, it actually put a lot of these groups on alert. So they have been scrambling to figure out with their legal counsel what this means for their fundraising for 2018, what they should be telling their donors, how they should change the script for asking for donations. And donors are already asking, well, what does this mean for me? How early could my identity be disclosed to the public? It's actually changed a lot of behaviors already.
Let me ask you one last thing. However this plays out, it still seems to me like a surprising decision by a Roberts court, a Citizens United court, to let stand this lower court decision that complicated life for political donors. Can we divine anything about this situation beyond its particulars?
There's very little we could read into the way the Supreme Court reacted here, because we don't know why that happened. We don't know whether that's because the other justices deadlocked 4-4 on this or whether they just wanted it to go through the full appeals process. We just have no idea. What is interesting about this, certainly in the context of Judge Kavanaugh's nomination, is that after this case goes through appeal, it could come back before the Supreme Court. And if there is a Justice Kavanaugh who is not a fan of donor disclosure or campaign finance regulations, it could really make a huge impact in the way campaign finance regulations are decided on at the Supreme Court level. So it has really interesting implications there just looking forward.
Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Michelle Yeohe Lee is a national reporter for The Washington Post.
Coming up, your moment of much-needed zen.
This is On the Media.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As I suggested a few minutes ago, apes don't deserve nice things. We have to evolve fast to earn our democratic system. This week in the New Republic, Rebecca Solnit recalls a Zen story she heard a long time ago, a samurai who demands that a sage explain heaven and hell to him. The sage replies by asking why he should explain anything to an idiot like the samurai. The latter becomes so enraged in response that he draws his sword and prepares to kill. The sage says, as the blade approaches, "That's hell." The samurai pauses, and realization begins to flood in. The sage says, "That's heaven." But how do you get there from here? How do we short-circuit the wiring that leads to embracing bad information that supports our views and the reflexive dismissal of the character and motives of those not within our own tribe? Bob Wright, author of Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment, told us last year that before we can get our minds moving in a healthier direction, we have to know where they've been.
Brains were designed by natural selection to do one thing, get genes into the next generation in a particular environment, in something more like a hunter-gatherer environment. And that's why I see crazy things like road rage that don't seem to make any sense. I mean, rage made a little more sense in a different environment.
Explain.
Well, in a hunter-gatherer environment, rage gets you to demonstrate that you cannot be taken advantage of. Somebody tries to steal a possession, a mate, whatever. You show you're willing to fight. You get mad enough to fight. Even if you lose the fight, you've demonstrated that there's a cost, okay? Well, you take this out on the highway. Well, first of all, nobody who's watching are you ever going to see again. There's no point in demonstrating anything to them. Plus, now you're going 80 miles an hour, and the consequences could be worse. And, you know, same with a lot of things. Anxiety, guilt, a lot of things kind of misfire in the modern environment.
Give me an example of how guilt misfires.
You might feel you did something to somebody. You wonder, did I offend them? And you feel a little guilty. But they're not, like, living right next door to you. You won't see them around the campfire that night. And that kind of thing can fester for a long time and just go unresolved. It's not quite worth emailing them about, and you're left there wondering. That just didn't happen in the natural environment. Everyone you interacted with pretty much all the time.
So what you've got is an accumulation of, like, a haystack full of little twigs that you carry around like a weight that are meaningless and that don't matter.
Yeah, well, one of the take-homes of Buddhism is that you should not assume that your feelings have the meaning they seem to have. You know, when they tell you this person is a bad person or you should be upset about this, don't assume that they're giving you good guidance. And mindfulness meditation is, to a large extent, a way of looking at your feelings from a more objective standpoint. It doesn't mean you don't have feelings. You experience them, but you exert more conscious control over which feelings you let carry you away and carry your train of thought away.
You are not the first person I would assume would take a plunge into Buddhism. You seem to be far more engaged in examining faith than in embracing it.
It's true that I'm not a natural meditator. It doesn't come easily to me. I don't have a good attention span.
Me either.
So
you have ADD?
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. I mean, to get into meditation at all, I had to go to a silent meditation retreat. Not everyone does, but that's what it took for somebody like me. But as for the fact that I'm analytical, as you said, I mean, mindfulness meditation is more analytical than people appreciate in the sense that it's a way of learning to kind of step back and analyze the feelings and thoughts inside your head, at least a way of viewing them with a kind of a calm objectivity.
I have an idea for spellbinding radio right now.
I'm ready.
Show me how to meditate.
Show you how to meditate. First of all, I don't have a license. No one should do anything I say from here on in. But what they typically say is, you know, close your eyes, assume a relaxed posture, pay attention to your breath. Maybe pick a point like where it's entering your nose and exiting your nose. Some people pay attention to the rising and falling of the abdomen. But pick something to pay attention to. And then, you know, just watch it. And your mind is going to wander. Don't get mad at yourself or beat yourself up. When you notice that your mind is wandering, that's a small kind of victory. So if anything, congratulate yourself. And then you'll get back to the breath.
Okay, your brain is calm. You've done the breathing for 2 hours or something. And once you've gotten good at that, no matter how many days it takes you, then you start concentrating on the sound of a bird outside the window, or what?
You could. I would say what's most relevant to this question of tribalism is focusing on your feelings and look at how you're reacting to things.
What feeling?
I remember I was at a retreat once and there was this guy who started snoring. He was falling asleep. And this really annoyed me. I'm like, I'm trying to meditate. And then I remembered, oh, wait, you're supposed to just be aware of your reaction. And the thing about a meditation retreat is you can get so, I guess you might say, good at this, at least temporarily, several days into a retreat, that once you see a feeling, like my kind of wrath for the person, I literally see it and I focus on it in a way that just dissolves it in the moment.
Now, you mean like as a big gray ball?
Well, you see where in your body, feelings reside somewhere in your body. If you are feeling sad and you sit down and just examine the sadness, which is a good shortcut, by the way, skip the breath, just wait until you have a feeling like sadness and sit down, close your eyes and say, well, what does sadness feel like? And you'll probably notice it tends to be some of it is up around your eyes and maybe elsewhere. But just the very act of observation, you're no longer thinking the sad thoughts that the sadness would make you think. Instead, you're just looking at the sadness. And that in itself is a measure of liberation.
You had mentioned that mindfulness helps you combat our natural tribalism because that's an emotional thing and you can identify it and then you can manage it better. And a big part of that is confirmation bias, which is our tendency to accept and retain information that supports our views and reject or ignore information that doesn't. Because in the final analysis, confirmation bias has nothing to do with thinking and everything to do with feeling.
Right. You know, confirmation bias is what drives fake news on both sides. You know, I think we've all done this thing of either sharing something on Facebook or retweeting something that turned out to be misleading or untrue, and we shared it without actually examining it. And if you ask yourself, why did you share it or retweet it? The answer is because it felt good. And that's the kind of feeling that you will become more aware of if you do mindfulness meditation.
There's another kind of bias that you talk about in the book that maybe holds treatment for our poisonous politics.
Yeah, there's a really fascinating cognitive bias that I think has not gotten enough attention. And it's a form of what's called attribution error. In everyday life, you might be standing at a checkout counter. The person in front of you is rude to the clerk, and you think that's a rude person. So you're attributing the rudeness to the kind of person they are. When, you know, for all you know, they have just found out that their spouse has cancer or something. You just don't know why they're behaving that way. And it turns out that how we do the attribution depends on whether somebody is in our tribe or outside of our tribe. So if it's somebody in our tribe and they do something good, we say, well, yeah, that's the kind of person they are. They're a good person. If they do something bad, then we explain it away and attribute it to circumstance. You know, they were under peer group pressure or whatever. Whereas people in the enemy tribe, if they do something bad, you say, yeah, naturally they did this thing. If they do something good, you explain it away as being due to circumstance. And I think this kind of thing, it gets us into wars, and it does help sustain the tribal conflict. And
But even more so, once you've got this explanation, you have no need to seek another.
Right.
So basically, this kind of attribution bias is a really big impediment to breaching the walls between tribes and increasing our understanding.
It impedes understanding. There are two kinds of empathy. People would imagine that the whole point of mindfulness meditation is to give you empathy in the traditional feel their pain sense. You know, in other words, emotional empathy. I feel sorry for the people on the other side. There's also something called cognitive empathy, which is just understanding what it's like to be them and why they do the things they do. And mindfulness meditation can help you, regardless of whether you even care about them, regardless of whether you feel their pain, it can help you get a clearer view of why they did the things they did. A calmer, more deliberate approach is the beginning of calming things down.
I also think getting exercised over the trivial invites fatigue and makes you less likely to sustain effective political action.
Right. Part of this is like a mental health issue. I mean, I just know a lot of people who spend a lot of time on Facebook or Twitter, and they wind up feeling horrible because they are so outraged. And I'm not advocating that you use meditation as some kind of insulation from what's going on. You could use meditation as a sedative. That's not what I'm recommending. I'm recommending using it to clarify your vision. The term I use is mindful resistance. I'm putting out a weekly newsletter now called the Mindful Resistance Newsletter. And it's an attempt to help people focus on things that are really important and process every day's news in a way that is conducive to their own mental health and conducive to their own effective action.
Bob, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Brooke.
Bob Wright is the author of Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment.
My fur coat solo load, ain't it cold? But I'm not gonna holler, cause I still got a dollar. And when I get low, oh, I get high. My man walked out, now you know that ain't right. Well, he'd better watch out if I meet him tonight. I said, when I get low, oh, I get high.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Feder, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Asta Chaturvedi and Samantha Maldonado, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. I'd also like to thank Tony Phillips for his wonderful John Adams. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.